You're listening to Stories That Matter, a Hawkwood podcast. Craig Bennett, Chief Executive of Friends of the Earth UK, was a speaker at Hawkwood Seed Festival in July this year. In this episode, he tells us about Friends of the Earth's changing campaigning strategy, the importance of diversifying the environmental movement, and how we can have hope in the face of climate change.
So I'm Craig Bennett, I'm Chief Executive at Friends of the Earth, and it's fantastic to come back to Hawkwood for the Seed Festival, where this afternoon I gave a talk which I called Climate Change the Solutions, where I tried to bring a bit of hope to the climate change debate and talk about how we can solve this enormous climate crisis as long as we really get on with it with bold action in six key areas.
It's funny that you say you're trying to bring a bit of hope, because I definitely came out of your talk thinking there are things that we can do, but I think also you sounded quite angry in your talk as well at the, and rightly so, at some of the kind of ridiculous policies that are in place or the things that we do. And so I wonder, how do you make sure that that anger gets turned towards hopeful action rather than into like the kind of vitriol we see online, which is so off-putting and nasty?
Well, I think it's fine to have a bit of anger and energy around things that are absurd. I mean, you know, right now, one of the things I was talking about in my talk was that actually the European Commission estimates that the UK government is offering around £10.5 billion of taxpayers' money in subsidies for the fossil fuel industry in this country to support fossil fuels, and actually only around £8.3 billion for renewables. To my mind, they should stop all subsidies absolutely for fossil fuels immediately, but of course ramp them up for renewables to make them come through much faster and to be even more effective. I get really angry about plans to build brand new roads right through urban green space and all the impact that would have. I get really frustrated at money being spent on really stupid infrastructure like HS2, and money's not there to put it in for local transport infrastructure like cycle lanes, supporting buses and public transport in all kinds of other ways in hundreds of towns and cities across the country. So there's lots of anger there, but actually anger is driven by sort of passion and determination around an issue and a belief that things can and should be different. And so I think for us at Friends of the Earth, what we've always tried to do is campaign for the solutions. Of course we campaign against the dumb stuff like fracking or new airports and all those things we know are bad, but actually we're trying to use that to build the energy and the passion and drive to support the solutions.
So you kind of mentioned one solution there of increasing subsidies for renewables. Can you go through some of the other solutions that you spoke about earlier?
So, I mean, I think renewables are doing really well by themselves in all kinds of ways, and many of them don't need subsidies now. My frustration is we could be moving so much faster. And given this is about, you know, tackling a global emergency, then that's a good thing to do. But you're right, some of the other solutions I was talking about this afternoon is around six key headings. One, for us to fundamentally cut emissions as fast as we can from our buildings. Principally, that's about making sure we have really good insulation in all our buildings. And of course, that just means we've got more comfortable buildings as well that lose less heat and are kind of warmer and more comfortable to sit in and are cheaper to heat. What's not to like? We talked about the huge changes we can do around transport, and that's around where we do move around in vehicles. You make sure that they're electric, but also move as much transport as we can to walking and cycling, which has other benefits in terms of keeping us fit and healthy anyway. We don't have to spend so much going to the gym or not going to the gym. around also our power industry, of course, as I said, stop burning fossil fuels. It's really that simple, really. Lots of things around the climate change debate are quite complicated. Actually, ultimately, it's quite simple. Stop burning fossil fuels and we can get our power from renewables instead. Stop building really silly infrastructure like HS2, new airports and so on. But one that I'm really excited about is around changing our land use, because I think agriculture and land use is one that's kind of got off a little bit scot-free over the years in the climate debate. And yet there's huge transformations that are possible there to help us solve the climate crisis. So, for example, we at Friends of the Earth have just launched a campaign to double tree cover in the UK. At the moment, tree cover in the UK is about 13%, but if we doubled it to 26%, that's still below the EU average of 35%. But doubling tree cover in the UK would actually result in trees going that would suck carbon down, draw carbon down from the air, equivalent to 10% of current UK emissions. Well, that's huge. But it would have all these other benefits as well of improving air quality, making more space for nature, having wonderful places that, make feel people feel better, and places for recreation and so on, flood alleviation, and so on. So all of those kind of benefits as well. And we could easily find the land to do that if actually we reduced meat consumption. So I'm not even saying that everyone needs to go veggie or vegan. I mean, some people would choose to do that, that's fine. But if we just halved meat consumption in this country, not only is it better for our health, it would make all that space, the land that could be released for growing trees or allowing trees to rewild, and we'd have a much greener country, a much healthier country, and we'd be drawing all that carbon down from the air. And we think you could do that by 2030, and that would make such a huge difference. So that's another really exciting solution. Equally, if we were restoring our peat bogs, that would be really powerful as well. So there's lots of things that we can do out there. It's a huge long list of things we can do. We've just got to get on and start doing it right now. Not next year, not in 10 years' time, 12 years' time, right now.
Do you think the current institutions that we have are capable of enacting that change?
Well, I think we have institutions that when the public, when citizens really demand they act, they can act. So it's kind of, I know at the moment everyone kind of has to talk about our politics being broken and our institutions broken, and there's a lot of things that are not good with it. But actually, what we really need to do as members of the public is send really clear, loud signals, and then the politicians will act. Because guess what? Generally, politicians act if they know, if it's in their self-interest, if they know it can get them or keep them elected. So rather than sitting back and just waiting and hoping that some kind of big green leader is going to come along in Parliament for us, it's down to us, the people, to really show the way here. That's why at Friends of the Earth, what we're doing is we're redoubling our efforts at the moment to support community groups up and down the country, hundreds of them, to form their own climate action groups, to campaign and push for climate solutions locally. I mean, right now, with the politics nationally where it's at, you know, hoping that Westminster Whitehall is suddenly going to wave a magic climate wand anytime soon, it seems unlikely. But if right across the country, hundreds of communities can come together and push for local climate solutions, then those local authorities will act. That's what they will do, and we'll be able to win that. And we're seeing local authorities really often showing the way on this. And finally, that will embarrass and push national government into action as well. So we have these institutions. They might not be perfect. They have all their kinds of problems. But if they're given a push and a shove, they will start to do the right things.
What does that local campaigning look like?
So the model that we're now using at Friends of the Earth is one called Network Change, which is basically to recognise that we shouldn't command and control from the centre about that campaigning. What we need to do is set a broad framing and broad goals for how the campaigning that people want to deliver, but then really support people to pick and choose the tactics locally that makes most sense to them. And so it might be that in one place, a climate action group might be campaigning to stop a road, like up in the one I was talking about up in Liverpool, that's going through urban green space. And that might be the most appropriate thing for them to do that. In another place, it might be that a community would prioritise planting more trees near their town and trying to double tree cover around their town or city. In another place, they might focus on insulation of buildings. Another place, they might focus on trying to get cycle routes in. And in all of these cases, there might be different levels of interest and different levels of opportunity for those communities to act on those different issues. But by working with us at Friends of the Earth, it will all be to that common framework, which will mean it adds up to something regionally and nationally. And of course, through Friends of the Earth, given that we're part of an international federation with groups in 75 countries, you also know that it's adding up to something globally.
One thing that the environmental movement often gets criticised for is for being a not very diverse group. How do you ensure that it's a diverse group that's doing that campaigning?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I mean, I've said many times that the environmental movement historically has been far too kind of white and middle class. And I think if we're going to be successful, you know, we have to get out of that white middle class ghetto. That means that organisations like ours have to really work long and consistently over trying to shift that. And number one, work on issues that really are relevant for those other kind of communities. and that means working on the issues that they care about rather than necessarily what we care about. But secondly, actually just providing the support for people to come through the sector and to get involved in the movement. One of the things we've done over the last 3 years at Friends of the Earth is we've had a big project called My World, My Home, where we've been working with something like 50 colleges across the UK, young colleges, and we've been supporting people to in their local campaigns. And actually around half of the participants of those have been non-white. And those have ended up being really passionate young campaigners who've learned campaigning skills and will go on to campaign, I'm sure, for the rest of their lives on these issues. We're also working in partnership with people like Muslim Climate Action to make sure that we can be campaigning and support climate campaigns and clean air pollution campaigns in communities that perhaps traditionally Friends of the Earth hasn't operated in. There are many, many more things we can do. But it's a really important thing to do for exactly the reasons you've outlined.
When you said often supporting a community means letting them work on the issues that they want to work on rather than the ones that Friends of the Earth want to, what's it like letting go of control in that way?
It's really exciting. What's fantastic is you end up then seeing campaigns that might be very different from what we planned for, but guess what? They're really inspiring and they're passionate. And it doesn't just mean we're diversifying the movement in terms of people, we're diversifying the movement in terms of experimenting with new kinds of campaigns and approaches. And some will work and some won't, but we can all learn from each other in doing that. And they will resonate with ever a wider diversity of people through that. So it's a very important thing to do.
How did you first get involved or kind of become aware of environmental issues?
So I first got involved in my teens, which was a long time ago now, back in the 1980s. I was growing up in Essex, and it was around the time of one of the first kind of big green waves when there was sort of an awakening of public concern around this. And I think I was about 14 or something at the time. And I was following the news and following the issues and particularly following Friends of the Earth as it happens. And I just found it really inspiring that people were coming together to kind of campaign on these issues. And I remember saying to my careers teacher at school when I was in sixth form or something, they said, "What do you want to be?" And I said, "An environmental campaigner." And he thought I was completely mad and told me that then printed off a sheet as to the A-levels I needed to do to become a careers teacher. Because he didn't have anything else. Actually, I got involved with Friends of the Earth local group at the time. I set up a campaigning group at my sixth form and also then at university as well. And actually learned a lot of campaigning craft, if you like, on those local campaigns, which still stay true now. So I think that's the thing, is that the great thing about the environmental community is that once you really get started into it, when you start campaigning on an issue that you're really passionate about locally and get involved and network with others through this amazing movement, then you get kind of ever drawn in, hooked into it. So I found it really inspiring to carry on campaigning around doing these issues throughout the whole of my life.
How have you seen the way that those issues are treated both within kind of environmental groups and the more mainstream public opinion? How have you seen that change since you first got involved?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, I think what's, if we look back, perhaps in the 1970s and 1980s, in some senses then, groups like Friends of the Earth were very successful in raising the concern about the environment broadly with big campaigns that really kind of captured the zeitgeist in a kind of big headline way, you know, Save the Whale type campaigns or Save the Rainforests and so on. And those campaigns, if you like, were kind of really strong totemic examples of what was happening to the world and saying the earth is in crisis and we need to do something about it. Then we were very, very successful. And I think perhaps in the late 1990s and certainly through the 2000s, we ended up finding ourselves with a lot more access to power and to decision makers, but perhaps we ended up confusing access with influence. So we find ourselves getting a bit more think tanky and policy wonky and so on, getting involved in all the kind of detail. And that perhaps was very enticing in giving us a sense that we were winning tangible goals. But perhaps during that process, we kind of lost touch with a lot of wider society and weren't always doing the kind of campaigns that brought about those long-term cultural shifts that are so important. Maybe we were winning lots of policy wins, which was good. But guess what? You can lose those very quickly when a different government comes in or ministers change or whatever. They can easily get wiped away. If actually you can fundamentally shift the values of society and the cultural values and zeitgeist of society, funny enough, that will last longer. And so we made the decision when I was director of campaigns at Friends of the Earth about 8-9 years ago, that we really wanted to very consciously run some big campaigns that kind of went back, if you like, to some big issues that shifted where society was on these. And the big one was we knew that we needed to run a big campaign that reconnected the British public again to nature, that really talked about the loss of nature, the loss of abundance of nature, the loss of ecosystem services and ecosystem function and biodiversity. But we wanted to do it without using any of those words. And we looked around what was happening and we saw bees in decline.
Sorry, why didn't you want to use those words?
Because those are technical words that wouldn't mean anything to a lot of people and certainly wouldn't engage hundreds of thousands of people. They would perhaps of people that are already, you know, they would work for preaching to the converted, but not reach out to new audiences. And so we looked around and what was happening, and it happened that bees were in decline. And so we ran a campaign on bees. But really the campaign on bees was not just about bees. It was like bees became an ambassador for that much bigger story about what we were doing to the natural world. And it was enormously successful. We had hundreds of thousands of people get involved with Friends of the Earth and campaigning that had never done so before. And enormously successful for shifting the public zeitgeist around these. And we've got lots of evidence to show that this is true. I mean, yes, we got some policy wins along the way and we got things like neonicotinoid pesticides banned, which was a great thing. But almost what's even more exciting is that now you go around and you see in countless town and city and you see roadside verges that are not cut short anymore. The grasses are being left to go wild. And everywhere you go, from here in Hawkwood to university campuses to parks and gardens right around towns and cities, you see areas of grass being left to go wild and create wildflower meadows. And that was not happening 10 years ago. 10 years ago, people were having these beautiful manicured, what was seen as beautiful manicured lawns, but of course were complete a desert for nature. And just when I arrived at King's Cross the other day from a train, there was a big stall there by B&Q trying to sell pollinating plants. That wouldn't have happened 10 years ago. And in a way, these changes, when you can shift the values and zeitgeist of society, these are bigger wins than even just individual policy wins. And it's less likely for us to shift back.
So that's really interesting, I think, that doing a kind of single issue campaign leads into a broader cultural shift rather than, because I might assume that, you know, if you're just doing like one single issue thing, people kind of, oh yeah, I'll work hard for that issue, but then I'll sort of forget everything else. I'm not going to be interested.
Well, I think you have to choose the issues very carefully. So bees absolutely were the perfect ambassador for that big issue. And at Friends of the Earth, we are now very much hoping and are confident that trees are the new bees. And that trees, calling for a campaign for doubling tree cover, it's not really just about trees. It's about connecting climate change and nature, because something that's driven me mad for years is that even people in our own community in the environmental movement often talk about climate change and the loss of nature as if they're separate issues. They're not. They're two symptoms of the same problem. So I think what we really wanted was a campaign that would link those two, and we're doing that around trees, but also tells a story about the need for changing for diets and all of these kind of things. I think actually our campaign on fracking, guess what? It's not really about fracking. It's an issue that's about leaving fossil fuels in the ground and moving on and saying goodbye to the fossil fuel economy. Same again, our campaign on plastics isn't really just about plastics. It's about a totemic example of overconsumption and unsustainable consumption. Oh, and by the way, plastics are also part of the fossil fuel economy. Our campaign on clean air was again another way to have a go at fossil fuels. And so all of our campaigns would be a lot more than what they might they might look like they're single issue, but if we devise them right and choose the right campaigns, actually they're symbols of much bigger shifts we need in society.
You mentioned having the pesticide that was really harmful for bees, having that banned. Are there any other kind of really concrete wins that you look at? I think I'm really proud of that moment.
There's loads, and they range from sort of quite small ones but make me smile when I think about them to much bigger ones. I mean, early in my career, I was very lucky to be campaigning for better wildlife protection, and in the run-up to the Countryside and Rights of Way Act. And there's lots of campaigning I did in Parliament right at the very end of that campaign, and we got certain clauses in the bill, everything from making it a crime to harass or negligently harass whales and dolphins on things like jet skis. And that was just something that we managed to get very late at night with a few of us from a number of different organisations working on that. Through to actually getting a legal duty on local authorities to take action on biodiversity locally. None of these were huge game changers, but it's nice when you know that, you know, you actually kind of did that. Equally, I worked on company law for a long time, and there's all kinds of things in company law that are there that place some sort of fairly gentle requirements, perhaps, on company directors to sort of have regard to environmental matters. Nothing like as strong as I would like, but at least it's something. And I know that in a lot of companies that's been used as one of the reasons that has driven slightly better behaviour. But I mean, over the last few years, the things I've been most proud about are our campaigns on bees, which has been very successful in making that big shift that I was talking about in society. Hugely proud of our campaign on fracking, which, you know, if we hadn't done that, if we hadn't alongside local communities that campaigned against it, chances are we would have a big fracking industry in Britain now that would cause immense harm to, yes, our countryside and our environment, but also would have locked us into a high carbon future. There's things that I've managed to campaign on in international agreements, which are there as well. And it's really exciting kind of see those. But it's worth bearing in mind that none of these, any big campaign, and this is the difference between campaigning and lobbying or advocacy, really. Campaigning is about involving and inspiring the public at large to take action and get involved in it. It's about building a movement, about to really build pressure. It's about a series of activities, not about just trying to win something in a darkened room late at night or something. And so that's why it's a real privilege that, you know, for people in my position, campaigners at Friends of the Earth, to be able to perhaps be there at that moment where we win a campaign that actually hundreds of thousands of people have been involved in making happen.
You drew the difference difference between campaigning and lobbying, and I read in an interview you gave earlier this year where you drew a distinction between Friends of the Earth and Extinction Rebellion as campaigning and protesting. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the emergence of Extinction Rebellion over the last year has been fantastic. I mean, they brought real vibrancy and urgency to the whole kind of climate debate, and that's been really, really welcome. But they shared with us their strategy early on, and they were very clear that they saw themselves as a protest movement, and they were very clear they weren't going to work directly on campaigning for the solutions. And I think that complements Friends of the Earth really well. I mean, we need that kind of activity that Extinction Rebellion is doing now, and it raises things up the agenda. But equally, we need the kind of work that Friends of the Earth, and particularly our local groups, our community groups, are doing in campaigning for solutions to climate change, both locally and nationally. So I think it's great when you can see organisations like Friends of the Earth and networks like Extinction Rebellion, I think, really complementing each other, and we can both achieve more by working alongside each other like that. And then you see the youth climate strikes, which I think have just been phenomenal and have given me more hope than I've had in years about how we're going to be able to really tackle the climate crisis. And what's even more exciting about that is it's authentic, you know. It's when the youth climate strikes emerged, I thought, well, this is amazing. I wonder if this is, who's behind this? I wonder, is it Greenpeace or someone else or something? And I phoned around, and no, it wasn't. And everyone else was phoning each other. And guess what? It really was Greta, and news spreading on social media. And so genuinely authentic and all the better for it. So really inspiring, really exciting.
You mentioned something in your talk earlier, which I hadn't heard of, which was after we get to net zero carbon emissions, we then need to go to net negative.
Mm.
I'd never heard of that.
Yeah, well, so think of it like this, is that, you know, carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere before the Industrial Revolution were, I think, something like 318 parts per million. And then we're now at well over 400, nearer 420 parts per million. So even if we stopped burning all fossil fuels tonight, turned them all off, that means carbon dioxide concentrations are up in the atmosphere. They will stay there for decades and they will still cause warming. And so actually we've got not only do we have to really focus on stopping emissions of greenhouse gases, we do have to think about, certainly in the second half of this century, once we've done that, then how we can actually lower concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere if we want to avoid some of those feedback loops, like the melting of the polar ice caps and drying of the Amazon rainforest, which risk and thawing of tundra and release of new methane and so on from the Arctic, all of which will happen unless we do that, and which actually will just make climate change get worse and worse and faster. So one of the things I was talking about in my talk is how you have kind of crazy kind of people out there saying, oh, we can do this by creating machines that will suck carbon out of the air, but they haven't invented these things yet or developed them. And I don't think they need to, because actually nature's done it brilliantly. And they're called trees and they do it for free. So actually, if we make more space for nature, and particularly make more space for trees, and not just trees, peat bogs do it, seagrasses do it, loads of different habitats do it. If we just make more space for nature and enable and support nature to restore itself, restore abundance and have a real focus on the restoration of nature, then that will pull carbon back down from the atmosphere and lock it into the biosphere, and then that will stop the worst excesses of climate happening. And that's another thing that gives us hope. You know, this is a crisis. Climate change is an emergency. It is a crisis. And there's lots of reasons to feel really concerned about that. Sometimes people feel despair. But actually, the real solutions to this crisis and this emergency are solutions that will also make life better for everyone. And I believe if we as a society can mobilise and focus on those kind of solutions, then actually the 21st century, rather than being the one where humanity really screws it up and makes life really difficult for itself, actually, if we play our cards right, if we focus on the right kind of solutions here, the 21st century can go from being a vision of hell for the future to one that is finally humanity working out how to live sustainably on this planet, as if we mean to stay. And I believe that's the next step of human progress. And if it's not that, what is it?
So the name of this podcast is Stories That Matter. And so I was wondering if there's a story that can either be from your life or that you've heard. It can be fact, it can be fiction, but some kind of story that's influenced what you're doing now.
Do you know, I think it's hard for me to think of one story, because I think what really inspires me is the hundreds, thousands even, of stories of people coming together in communities around the world to campaign for a better future. Whether that's campaigning as they did decades ago, hundreds of years ago, for the abolition of slavery or universal suffrage, or whether what we see now, hundreds, thousands of communities around the world campaigning to both protect their local environment and protect their rights, but actually campaigning for a better world as well, to restore the environment, to make sure that we can live in harmony with nature and the environment. And, you know, there's no one big story of like one big person doing this. It's a story of hundreds and thousands of communities campaigning right around the world for this. And that's also what gives me hope that this is a big shift in the future of humanity. You know, when you look at all those steps in the story of human progress that have lasted, So the emergence of agriculture, the emergence of language, the development of tools, even settlement and so on. These are all things that happened in many different locations simultaneously. And that's why they became part of the history of humanity. And what you saw in the, you know, we're recording this podcast on the day that's 50 years to the day after humans first walked on the moon. And what you saw around that time was this huge explosion of the modern environmental movement, as for the first time that humanity saw photos of looking back at Earth, of that blue dot sitting there in the darkness of space. And I think it led to a realization in humanity for the first time, really deep realization that we are all alone. This is our home. We only have one home, this planet. And we've got to look after it. And, you know, things move slowly sometimes. Culture moves slowly. Society can move slowly in some ways. But just five decades on, actually, we now have had the emergence of a really strong environmental movement in every country around the world. You know, every single part of the world now, communities are campaigning for a better, more sustainable relationship with nature. And I think it is the equivalent of the emergence of agriculture and settlement and stone tools and so on. It's the next step in human progress, is to learn how to live in balance with nature. I just ask yourself this question: if it's not that, what is it? Because there isn't any progress for humanity unless we learn to do that.
Thanks for listening to Stories That Matter, a Hawkwood podcast. To find out more about Hawkwood and Seed Festival, follow the links in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share it with your friends. This episode was produced by Laura Bing, with music by Daisy and her Cora, playing an original composition, Berta.